history with DeLon, D-E-L-L-O-N, Wilson, for the Crown Heights History Project. This is Jill Bexler on November 10th, 1993. Yeah. Anyway, you'll just forget this. DeLon, where were you born?
I was born in Jamaica.
What part of Jamaica?
It's St. Anne.
I've been there many times. Yeah. And how old are you?
36.
And are you a citizen of what country now?
The U.S. I feel like I have dual citizenship because I really have to give up my U.S. Jamaican passport.
And since when have you been a U.S. citizen?
It's been 10 years.
But you live, where do you live most of the time?
My years? I've been here 24 years.
Oh, wow. So what year was that you came in? So
it's I came in 1970. Well, let me see. It'll be in 1970. That's when I took 23 years.
Did you first come to New York, or how did you? What was your route from St. Anne to Kingston to?
Did I first come to New York? I grew up. Was born in St. Anne. I grew up in Kingston. I was 5 years old. I remember going to Kingston to be with my aunt. From there, you know, I went back and forth to the country, and I remember. My mom came and got us, and we left from Kingston to JFK. Then I went up to Westchester. That's where I grew up.
And so you went to school?
I went to school in Greenberg first. You know, Greenberg Junior High, seventh grade.
And high school?
And then I went to high school. Part of my time was in Greenberg. I went to Woodlands High School. And then I moved. My parents moved to White Plains, and I moved to White Plains, and then I finished my high school in White Plains.
White Plains High?
Yeah.
I used to teach there.
Really?
Yeah, it was a short team teaching project, pairing an architect and an anthropologist to teach for 2 weeks a year, two weeks a semester. And
I graduated in 76.
Yeah,
you were
no, this
a
was
baby then, right?
76. No, I graduated. I finished my doctorate in 76. Yeah, now I'm a little older, right? And you've been living here on Eastern Parkway since
1980.
A long time. Is this a co-op or?
No, it's rental.
And did you go on to college after?
Well, long story. After I graduated high school, instead of enrolling into a college, which I did, but I really thought about helping my parents out by joining the U.S. Army.
Oh, yeah.
So whereas I had a better plan, I mean, instead of them spending money on me, what I could have done, what I did was I joined the service and I got my education while being in the Army, and I also got their basic education also.
So that with, as an enrolled... Volunteer enlisted person, you could go to the college of your choice, or was it one affiliated?
No, you go to the college that's affiliated closer to the Army base, that they could, you know, wherever they could get credits, like certain colleges took Army credits, and you could go there at night.
So where were you based?
I was based at Fort Sam Houston, Texas.
I'm from San Antonio, Texas.
Yeah.
In fact, my high school is very close to Fort Sam. May I?
Yeah.
Fort Sam.
We can pull that up.
My high school is close to Fort Sam. My mother grew up on Army Boulevard. Yeah, that street on the side.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, no, I know.
I like Texas. My family's there, and half my family, my sister and husband.
Where were
And her kids. They're in Houston, though.
There's a large West Indian community in Houston. It's the only city in Texas that has a sizable West Indian community.
Yeah, in Houston.
Mm-hmm. The man who sat next to me on the flight Sunday is Jamaican, who lives in Houston.
Right.
Yeah, he's telling me it's growing.
Yeah, my sister, she's one of the organizers there, or the group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's what he was telling you.
Yeah.
It's new.
So, I joined the service, and I did 4 years volunteer service, and then I came out and I did 2 years reserve, you know, while I was working.
What did you study while you were?
They call it lab specialist. That would be like a lab technician.
Mm-hmm.
And you got credits, college credits for that. Plus, you know, I went to school at night, so I got like... I could take my electives there when I was in
Trinity. Trinity?
Yeah.
Trinity.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I went to Baylor University in Texas.
Huh.
Yeah. I got my credits there also.
Were you affiliated with the med school?
No. I didn't have enough credits, you know, to do what I wanted to do there. Then after basic training, I went to, my assignment was at Fort Knox, Kentucky. I mean, all the places.
Right.
So I went to Fort Knox. I wanted to go to Europe, somewhere far. And there I went to Kentucky University and I got more credits.
Because
that was my permanent station. And from there, I continued. I got a Bayside swap, they call it, from Fort Knox, Kentucky to Fort Dix, New Jersey, because I thought then I wanted to be closer to home. And that worked out pretty good also. Went to Burlington Community College there for some extra credits. And when I was in Kentucky, I went to Kentucky University. So I had all these different credits and everything, and, you know, short my degree. And when I got out, I finished up between New York University and went to college.
And what?
So I have a biology degree, and I also have a theater and a film production degree.
So is that a BS, BA?
I have a MS and a BA. And a certificate of, also from New York University, as a field engineer. Because at that time, you know, I was working at the medical examiner's office for around 8 years. So,
forensic medicine?
Yes, forensic medicine. I specialize in it. So, I wanted to do something extra in computers, you know. So I took this other subject for a year or so at New York University for computer field engineering. You know, just knowing the aspect, different aspect of it, and how to fix them and so on.
Okay.
Yeah, but I never got the job I wanted.
Are you working with that now?
Unfortunately, I'm on disability because I got exposed to. After working in the laboratories for 7-8 years, I got exposed to the chemical, benzene phenol, while I was working at the medical examiner's office.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so it's like my days have been, you know, changed.
Things so it's happen. A toxic?
Yeah, I'm exposed to toxic chemicals. So I have, like, cancer, you know, working with that. Well, the name of it, aplastic anemia, which is some form of it, yeah. Yeah, so I'm getting treated.
So the treatments, you have your energy?
No, most of the time I don't, but, you know, we get good treatment. I'm at Sloan Memorial, which is one of the best hospitals in the world, so it's a private hospital. They offer the help, because I'm working with them, but... During all of that, it didn't stop me from being the type of person that I want to be. I'm discouraged because I love working, making money. But,
what's your favorite aspect of the work?
As far as the microbiologist?
Right.
My favorite part is to do the diagnostic test, like doing, you know, like special procedure and staining and actually see the product of the, because I worked in specializing in histology, mm-hmm. you know, to see the product. The product at the end, my end result, to see that product, whether I do a special slide for the pathologist, you know, that microscopic
slide
that comes out right. with a perfect, you know, perfect view.
Well, that's the essential step, so that the pathologist.
Right, yeah, we work with a lot of decomposed tissues and various different things. So. We have to do a lot of microscopic evaluation. We have to bring the tissue, take it through many different steps.
Is that kind of the coroner's office?
Yes, it was the medical examiner's office on 31st. Yeah. At that time, Dr. Elliot Gross hired me, you know.
I've heard his name,
right.
sure.
Yeah. And I worked there for about over seven years.
How did you We've talked all day about the stories from there, I'm sure. Kind of gruesome, some of them.
Yes. You know, got a lot of publicity from the media. But I'm not there anymore for the past 6 years. So I've been doing, like, you know, volunteer myself for different odd jobs. I'm being creative. More so the theater, the arts, because I love the arts. That was my best subject, the thing that I like most. But, you know, my parents, it's like, you have to be a lawyer, a doctor. You can't be a dancer. You can't be an actor. Come on, these people don't make any money. You know, so,
very
you know, they always, West Indian parents are very, very pushy when it comes to what they want for their children, because you must be better than, you must be the best, you must, and if not the best, you must have a profession that stands out, you know, that you must have that pride and dignity, you must work hard and get it, because if we don't have it, we want you to get it, and if we have it, we want you to achieve much more than what we did, you know, it's always to become better and better and better. But my thing was, forget all of that, Ma, I just want to dance. I love dancing. And I love acting. Let me do the things that I want to do.
You can be great within those.
Yeah, so what I did both.
Wonderful.
I did both.
And what theater or dance groups are you involved in?
Well, at this point, I can't, you know, I haven't done anything in the past 6 years because my whole physical body has, you know, I call it erupted in its own method. I mean, I'm very tired. I can't let my joints rub too much or, you know, bleeding problem or what have you. So, you know, I do a lot of visualization or I do more so, you know, like help put on productions and do things that, acting or what have you, but things that I don't have to exert myself at. So, you know, I work a lot with the women's movement. I volunteer for services. And I've done a lot with kids. I help with the, you know, the AIDS community.
In Brooklyn?
I do, Manhattan, you know, it's like the gay men's and I went to Jamaica, and I also, now they had formed a group there as far as getting together the AIDS crisis for the people of color,
right?
That Caribbean, you know, it's like helping everyone. It doesn't matter who they are.
Are you familiar with a group, a women's drama and different aspects of cooperative programs? based in Kingston called Sistrin.
Yes. Yeah. I know those sisters. Yeah. Some of them. Yeah. I know.
I'm trying to think of. The last time I was in Kingston was 6 years ago. I was working on a UNESCO project, and my friend, whom I've known for 20 years almost, said, come see this production.
Right.
And then we ended, the whole gang ended up taking me with them to a weekend, because it was a 3-day weekend for a holiday. And fantastic women, absolutely great. And they were approaching health and childcare and through drama and through their programs and through artwork and selling t-shirts and artwork cards because it was a source of income to finance the program.
Yeah, it's really, it's very difficult because the government really don't finance or help to finance the group. It's just like the AIDS program that the projects that these young men and women that's forming in Jamaica. It's not government, you know, it's definitely not, the governments really don't help with the projects or help donate money or what have you. So it's these people getting together and, you know, doing little benefits and, you know, just trying to, and also with the gay mental health crisis here, they get a lot of, condoms and various different things to there, so it could help boost, you know, the morale, because it's there. I mean, the AIDS is there, it's all over the world, you know, and somebody has to start it. And how they started it, they were walking by somebody's apartment, it had a foul smell in it, and when they walked in, you know, there was this person who was dead in his apartment for days and weeks. No one knew,
And he had died of AIDS.
Right, but no one knew what he died of. I mean, no one knew at that point that's what it was. Mm-hmm. The only thing is the group of theater people there who helped to start this project. They went in and they got this body out and what have you, and, you know, later, at a later point, they found out that, you know, this person had the virus. But they didn't care. They just wanted to, you know, they said, if this is what's going on, and a lot of people are unaware of it, or they're so afraid of it, it's time for somebody to do something. So, you know.
But the Public Health Institute of Jamaica hasn't established any formal programs for?
Well, I think now they're doing, they're definitely, they have to be a part of it because it's part of the people, it's part of the community. So hopefully, eventually, you know, they are aware of it. Whether or not they're helping, I don't know at this point. But hopefully they'll, you know, start, because it's going to really look bad. Public health system there, you know, but I plan on helping also as far as benefits, if I can give a benefit party in honor of this project, you know, that's what I do, you know, I try to help people who need help at this point in time, and I really concentrate on the women's community, because there isn't much help. As far as, you know.
Are you speaking about the Jamaican community in New York?
Yeah, the Jamaican community. But overall, you know, even the women's community here, you know, there's a lot of projects and a lot of offers, but a lot of times people don't know about them. So it's a matter of just connecting.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. What do you find the best means of communication, of making those connections is? Or are there several?
Well, there's several. It's first, you know, I have dialogue with a lot of people because of my situation, number one. And what it is, it's like you call a friend or you call an associate or call these different groups, you know, because they're out there, you know, and through counselors and various different things, you just have a network of what's happening. And you call these different groups, and it's like they're ready to help you out there. You know, it's like they're looking for people to connect with them, you know, and sometimes it's hard for them to connect with people, especially people of color, because they don't, you know, it's like a communication problem, some of us. So, you know, it's like, you know, okay, you need help, or whoever needs help, this is the way you do it. So it's like that method of communication that, you know, you go to them and say, if anyone needs help, you know, this is the way you do it. Here are some pamphlets, this is the way you have safe sex, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, you know, you have to go in and educate, because we do have a lot of illiteracy in the community. So we go and we try to, you know, help to educate the people and to let them know, you know, we have all of this here, it's up to you.
Do you find that the English you use, the way you communicate this really gut behavioral information has to be adapted or is adapted to speaking to an African American born in New York, to a Caribbean, to a different specific country within the Caribbean?
Well, the way we speak.
The way you talk, the way your communication is successful.
Well, you know, it's like speaking with someone from the West Indian or the Caribbean or wherever, Africa, what have you, people are very sensitive. Like with Black Americans, I'm comfortable at most of the times because I can just say, that's that. And, mm-hmm. you know, they understand because this is the way here. But with the West Indian folks, you have to really sit down and you have to make them feel comfortable, you know, so they can trust you because, you know, we are very paranoid of people who want to give us information about things that we don't understand or we might not know. So, you know, you have to have that trust. First, they got to trust you. Mm-hmm. And then they'll open up, you know. But the dialogue, yes, it's a little bit different, mm-hmm. you know. And knowing both customs or both culture, I find it easy to have dialogue with, whether it's Black Americans or West Indians. You know, it's I have that mobility to do either or.
Yeah, that's the word I was thinking of, mobility. Mm-hmm. Just going back for a second to Lama, mm-hmm. I thought of something. In White Plains, mm-hmm. you graduated from high school in, what, 70-something?
Yeah, 76, yeah.
76, mm-hmm. okay. White Plains High School in 76, let's see, I knew White Plains High School in 86.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was really very diverse. Mm-hmm. Much more than I had ever imagined. There were mm-hmm. 10 different Latin American countries there, and people from Ecuador mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in that high school, and an enormous variety in 86 mm-hmm. of West Indian countries.
Right.
What was it like when you were there, uh-huh. and what was your circle of friends like?
Mine started out really... Can I just go back a little bit?
Of course.
When I first came,
sure.
yeah, when I first
sure.
came here to this country and I started school, it was a very difficult period for me because first of all, the Black Americans, you know, most of them, they did not hear anyone with an accent in the 70s.
Sure.
Like, you know, and there was a sort of turmoil there also because that was like in what, 68, you know. With Martin Luther King and whatever, it was all of that. So there wasn't a lot of Blacks in my school. And the ones who were, it was a little bit difficult to communicate with me because I spoke with an accent. And by them not knowing or that everyone has an accent, mm-hmm. you know. But mine was like really deep and different, you know. So it took them a little time to get used to me. I had to fight my way through school until I was recognized as, you know, a person speaking with a different accent. Anyway, it was a little problem, but when I, you know, after fighting a couple of fights and getting in trouble and all of that, I got recognized, and then, it was more so like in high school, my first year of high school, you know, where there was a small percentage of blacks and Spanish, and you know, the percentage was really, we stood out. That people began to really accept us, but it's like it was like a couple of us there who were like either they were West Indian first generation or new West Indian young kids who came in. We had to fight our way for the other West Indian folks to come in and to feel right. You know, we all had our own circle. We gathered together as one. Because regardless of country, because the fact is that we were West Indians,
right,
and we spoke differently. And even though we all had different accents in different countries, we could communicate with each other, or we felt comfortable enough. So when a new student came in, we befriend that person immediately so they could feel comfortable. So we were the ones that had to fight and had to go through whatever it is to be accepted. But once we were there, we contributed. There was, whether it was dancing, then, you know, we started having a Caribbean club, and you know, different things we could participate in. A lot of people, they didn't know how to play in sports. We had to help these people. You know, we taught them the sport because we knew the sports. The American sports. And then the black Americans, they start to appreciate us and bring us in a lot. But most of my friends, when I grew up in White Plains, you know, they were white. Because the blacks would not accept me. And the whites, they knew, well, there's a country here in Jamaica. Jamaica's Jamaica. And at that time, you know, of course, people were saying, you came on a banana boat. And I'm saying, well, I flew over here in a 727, you know. But they could not understand that. It was still that 40s and 50s and 30s and 20s, you know, when the West Indian migrated over here in that banana boat theory. You know, and so it was very tough, you know, to explain to one of the black Americans, like, you know, I didn't come over here in a banana boat, and how dare you? So even though there was a lot of prejudice and a lot of things going on, the whites, like, took us in, basically, you know, as friends. They were my friends, until, like, once they saw that, once the black American saw that, it was a way of saying, okay, if the whites will accept you, then you must be okay. And, you know,
interesting circle.
It's really weird, and I have yet to tell a lot of people, but I do share it with my American friends at times, because it was really strange back then in the early 70s. We had a very difficult time, extremely difficult times, and West Indians, forget it. We were, there was comments like, you don't wear any clothes, you know, you live on the tree, you know, that, you know.
That African Americans.
Yeah, made. Yeah. It was that cannibalistic type of lifestyle that we live, you know, and I'm saying, you know, I always fought for my country and fought for the right. I said, if you knew where I'm coming from, a paradise, you know, and I said, I didn't ask to be here. My parents wanted us here, you know, because where I'm coming from, the sun shines.
St. Anne's gorgeous.
You know, it's a garden parish. I mean, the ocean is so beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful.
And we had to dress in uniforms to go to school. So there was a lot of changes for me, you know, because not wearing jeans or, you know, my high waters and sneakers at that time, it was difficult because I didn't, you know, my parents bought stuff for us. We weren't used to that to wear to school. We had uniforms. I mean, so
how is it that your parents made the decision to come?
Well, you know, in the West Indies, a lot of times in the 60s and the 50s, as I recall, you know, it was an opportunity to have a better life.
Sure.
And my father, he was a school teacher and carpenter, and he was all these trades. So he was fine. But my mom, you know, she was a housewife, and she also, she was like a midwife. She delivered a lot of kids in the island, but not a certified midwife, though, you know, she wasn't certified. You know, it's like they trained these girls how to do this, you know, the nurses. And
how had your mother learned?
Well, she learned from the nurse that was there, when they call them a matron. She learned from her, you know, she went with her each time, and you know, my mom was pretty good at that, you know, and she came here, and just like anyone else, and she started working. She was sponsored by a family, and she worked as a maid, you know, for a while, and until she could get on her feet, and then she sponsor her family over here, and she went on into the nursing field, and that's how we got here. My father was totally objective to that, because you know, he did not want to leave this country. He had his thing he wanted to do, but you know, she had to make a move, and when she made that move, he didn't like it, but she did it. And once she did that, then he appreciated it. Because once he came here and he saw, well, you know, he could, he had opportunities of doing certain things, you know, he did it. And then he decided to leave after we got into, you know, colleges or what have you. We grew up to be a certain age. My dad left, and my mom, after a couple of years, had to retire to, you know, to go take care of him.
So it was really her move.
Yeah, it was her move. Yeah, it was my mother's move. The women there are very aggressive, and they have a lot of times they take action.
When you say we, how many brothers, sisters are you?
Well, I have a lot of half brothers. Uh-huh. My dad, I have four half brothers, and as far as from my both parents, mm-hmm. it's two of us, two girls, but I have one half sister, and the rest of them half brothers. Yeah.
So all of you came up?
No, not everyone. Just for my mom and dad, my sister and I. Yeah, that was it. And then everybody came after.
And that's your sister who's in Houston now.
Right.
So you're the only one in the East? In the Northeast?
I have two brothers here living in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Two more brothers. And
what part of Brooklyn do they live in?
One lives in Crown Heights. So Maverick, he was my roommate for a long time. Mm-hmm. And as he brought his family up here, and he has, of course, you know, first, second generation kids here. So that first and second, but first, I should
first.
Say, yeah, you know, he had to move out, and he has his own place with his family. Mm-hmm. And here in Crown Heights, so I'm just glad for him.
So, just again, Jeff, mm-hmm. when you decided to move to New York City, mm-hmm. how did you select this part of town to live in?
Brooklyn.
And
well, after I got out of the service, I moved to Gramercy Park mm-hmm. at that time with my lover. And after the relationship was out, I decided that I had to move. And living in Manhattan was really beautiful in the 70s. I mean, in the 80s, early 80s, because that was like 80. I needed a space that was large, and as a matter of fact, we both decided to move to Brooklyn, and we got this large apartment, because that was first I chose apartment, a one-bedroom apartment, but it was too much for me, because, you know, it was a lot of rodents, and it was just awful. I mean, it looked good, but after a while living there, I couldn't tolerate the noise, because I was going to school full-time, I was working full-time, and I needed a space that would be very quiet, you know? And so this apartment was like totally renovated. It was very new. It was renovated, and it had this new look, and some friends connected me with the manager, and I moved in here. And, you know, got this large apartment. And I've been here ever since.
So you've been here since 80, what?
Yeah, since about
83?
I've been here.
Since?
Yeah, I've been here 12 years.
1980?
Yeah.
Right. So you know the neighborhood pretty well?
Yes, I know the neighborhood pretty well. Because I used to ride my cycle, through the neighborhood. And plus, I do a lot of driving. And you know, the West Indian community is also a part of the West Indian community to me. And I felt very comfortable because the food that I ate was important to me. And I like West Indian food. You know, I like American food, but I love West Indian food.
Right.
So I could get both, you know.
Right here.
I mean, I just have to walk a half a block.
So Franklin is pretty much the commercial center for the West Indian.
Well,
shopping.
Franklin and Nostrand. It's like all the street parallel to it.
Right.
You know, you can get your food.
Have you seen in these 12, 13 years you've lived in this neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
a change in the commercial, the ways that the stores reflect the Caribbean community, or was that already pretty well established then?
Back then it was, but now you have more of a competition. Like you have a lot of West Indians here owning stores,
mm-hmm.
you know, more so restaurants, takeout food.
Mm-hmm.
But you definitely see like more of a variety of food and vegetables and, you know,
right.
dry food and canned food sometimes. But, you know, I tend to stay away from the canned food, the chemicals. But, yeah, a lot of the products, much more. But at that particular time, 12 years ago, you know, well, actually 13 years ago, I could get the same thing that I want now, you
right.
know, the dry food, the yams and the bananas and, you know, codfish and things like that. Yeah.
And the chilies.
Mm-hmm.
Among the West Indian community here, does it kind of break down in your mind of certain countries that have more residents here than others, and which seem to be the dominant countries?
Well, here in my area,
in your
here
area.
Crown Heights,
right.
Panamanian is a large dominant around here.
English speaking?
No, Spanish speaking. Yeah, they do speak English because, of course, you know, they're here in America, but the majority of them speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
But in this area, I have a cross between Americans from the South and West Indians, a lot of Jamaicans. So I would say the dominance here is Jamaicans and Black Americans, and then come Panamanians, because we have a large group of Panamanians.
What about some of the other islands?
Yeah, we have definitely Trinidadians.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they're right next behind the Panamanians.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the Antiguans. And, you know, we have a lot of Barbadians. It's really I don't know the survey, like how many of us
Craig
are here, you know, but a lot of Barbadians and you name it. Then, of course, we have a whole bunch of Haitians, you know, like that I should even say is close to the Panamanian, to the amount of Haitians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have the Spanishers with the Panamanians and Dominicans and Puerto Ricans. We do have not a lot of Puerto Ricans, more so, you know, Panamanians.
How do you?
And the Jewish community, I can't forget that, because
right.
It's like 4 or 5 blocks, and then we have the Jewish community, and it's really. You know, the community is so unique because on the outskirts you have the West Indians and the Black Americans, And then on the inskirt is, you know, you have the white community, you have the Jewish community, and, you know, and it's like they're very much, they stick very much to themselves, you know. And I guess all the other community, it's like we mix outside, but they stick very much to themselves because they have the synagogue here on Eastern Parkway, and everything is within, you know, and their stores are within the community. But we all can go and buy from their stores and everything, but they don't come out that their community and buy from us, you know. Mm-hmm. But once in a while, and the people who are within that community, that's where we go for the dermatologists. We have, you know, they have a few blacks who live in their community, you know, but more so they're professionals, because the doctors and majority of doctors and lawyers. You know, you'll find a couple of blacks there, but you know, that's
so
how
do
it
you,
is.
Have you had many encounters, any conversations with any of the Jewish residents? It's really so close.
Yes, I do have encounters, but as far as problems, I don't, because I go in. You know, I might have a doctor, like. Mm-hmm. You know, my doctor, one of my doctors, you know, he's Jewish, and his wife are going and getting taken care of, and they, I'm not like they have a lot of black patients, you know. So I just go in, and then, you know, 6-7 blocks my home, I come home, and I don't have any problems with that big riot that we had, and that problematic situation was devastating, because I know West Indian people, they really don't get upset. They don't get perturbed unless somebody upset them or a situation upset them, mm-hmm. you know. I've never seen it like that.
Were there many West Indians involved?
Yes, there was West Indian involved because, you know, yeah, they were. They were because, you know, it's like once you say black, you know, it's not even about black Americans. It shouldn't even be like black Americans or black West Indian. West Indian, the people from the West Indian, majority, 99% of them are black. Well, I mean, you know, or 95%, whether you're mixed or whatever, you're black. So it's a matter of, because the family was West Indian that the kid, you know, got hurt from. And I think when that was out, you know, it's that big news flash. Then the West Indian people, they of course, they're part of it. They're a big part of it because it's like we don't bother anyone, you know. But you know, when it comes to kids or the elderly or a person that's sick, you know, it's like the West Indian community get upset. Especially, you know, they love their children and the elderly person. You know, because we're brought up like that, you have to always respect and you stand up and you fight when it comes to family or situation like that. So, you know, the injustice.
You know. Have you sensed in conversations and just kind of vibes animosity among your circle of friends, whether they were, your circle of people, whether they're friends or not? Be they African American or Caribbean, about the Jewish presence in the neighborhood?
No, I mean, we don't have problems with the Jewish presence in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That's not the problem. The problem occurred when the accident occurred back then, and the kid was hit, and you know, and there wasn't anything done. And you know, those days of waiting for justice and blah, blah, blah. And then it's okay, revenge, you know. One situation happened and another situation, you know. And it's like, it's the unjust cause and all these different things take into play. I think people start talking. And the media hype things up so much. I think sometimes if they just leave things alone, sometimes people in the community can settle it. But when you're hearing things and it's not true, and it's not true, then people get upset. And then, of course, you know, people's blood begin to boil, because then it becomes a racial thing, and then from that, you know, it's like, you know, telling someone, having a group of friends in a circle and telling that person one thing, and then when it comes back to you, it's not the same. You know, it's like the same thing happened here in the community, you know, because we really, you know, we have a little problems once in a while with attitudes, but we really never had anything that was so big and just out of control, you know. And then people came from all over, you know, and of course, it triggers problems.
What was it like as you looked out your window that August?
Well, being as I'm right here by the museum, there wasn't a lot of things happening here.
Right.
You know, it was like further down by Utica Avenue into that area. But of course, there was a lot of people upset. I heard talks. If you go to the grocery store, there was a lot of talk. If you go to the, you know, I go get my hair done. It's a, I went to my hairstylist, you know, is from Haiti. So there was a lot of problems. You know, the talk was out. And everybody, all the groups were upset because they're saying if it's their child, you know, innocent person playing a kid and da-da-da, and somebody's drunk driving, hit the kid and nothing is happening, and blah, blah, blah. And you see, then things boil up, and then the media did most of the injustice here. You know, and the more people hear, it's the more they get upset.
Right.
And then it was one thing to another. So when I'm driving by and I'm seeing everybody's like a whole group of folks coming down and they're upset, and it's like traffic is stopping. You know, anger, rage. You know, people talking things they don't know.
But what are some examples of sentences or statements you heard that were out of proportion or incorrect or distortions of what you knew was more accurate?
Well,
either that you heard on the street or read in the paper or heard on the news.
That was inaccurate. You know, it's like the fact that they blame a lot of things on the mayor, Mayor Koch, Mayor Dinkins.
Well, they're both history.
You know, it's like, what do they want this man to do? You know, I feel really bad about how they disgrace him and discredit him for this. Like it's his fault and he should have done something to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a lot of times the media was just really putting on show, and you know, okay, I mean, Mr. Dinkins, Mayor Dinkins had things to do, and he didn't know what was really happening here, because see, it's like the people were planning and doing their own stuff. Everybody was planning and doing whatever it is that they wanted to do, and a lot of negative things were said about the mayor, that he didn't move on time, you know, he didn't care.
Side two. Okay. Yeah, people love that.
Right. So a lot of negative things was about the mayor and the reason why he didn't come and all of that from the community, both black and white. So.
When you say people were planning things, what are you referring to?
Well, I mean, there were different groups forming. There, you know,
to
and I'm talking about the Hasidics also, and also the blacks. You know, it's a little rival. When I say rival, I know as far as I can speak for the blacks, that, you know, it's like they were sick of. I think, you know, in 93, here it is. You know, we still have prejudice at the highest point. You know, and their thing was they're tired of getting beat on or hurt, you know, of different incidents that happened in the U.S., you know, of groups and what have you. And Their thing was, you know, specifically...
But specific to the neighborhood, were there things that were under the surface?
No. There wasn't anything under the surface. I'm telling you, for all these years, we all lived together. Nobody bothered anyone.
Yeah.
And if there's a shout, an incident or something, it's, you know...
That happens in New York.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, people talk, they talk negative, and that's it. But it's people, an ethnic, different ethnic background, you know? But we basically got along. The fact is, you know, I felt I was caught up into something, and of course, I'm a black woman, so, you know, I felt like, you know, there was some unjustness, you know, unjust things that occurred that I thought should be looked into, and one group should not really be praised or treated different than the other group. There was a situation that occurred, and we should have taken care of it prior to it getting to a very bad, you know, point, as far as rioting and all of that, you know. And I don't think it's Amir's fault that he got here, like, saying 2 or 3 days later.
No.
You know, he was up on it. Not only that, the mayor has people that work for him on these specific things, you know, and or situations. So,
right.
And the police were there, you know. The police, again, is another situation. It's like, you know, everybody's going to feel a certain way. They're humans, and they act up, too, you know? I mean, they're here for us in the community. They're supposed to be here for the people. It shouldn't matter what you're black or white, but hey, the situation occur and some things are happening. People choose sides, you know? I'm not saying that what took place is all correct. I don't want to call names and, you know, try to create something worse than it is.
As a black woman, with the confrontation and anger here or without it, what have you felt is unjust that should be addressed?
Well, there is a situation. I don't believe. See, a lot of people are saying eye for an eye, you know, or
yeah.
I wasn't raised that way.
No.
If something goes wrong in a situation, take care of it to the best of your ability. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
There was an accident that occurred, and it was a bad accident. The person was on alcohol influence. Take care of that, you know?
The driver of the car.
Yeah, take care of the driver, you know, take care of the situation with the family, and take care of the situation as far as the driver, you know? Instead of letting things go, and then things became so chaotic, you know? Because that's what it was. Everything boiled down to an eye for an eye. And then when you start taking out, when each person, each individual start plucking each other's eye because of something that went wrong, then there needs some kind of restraint on what it is that's going wrong in the community. And that's where the media came in and tried to blow things out of proportion, you know? The group didn't think of eye for an eye. They wanted the situation that occurred to be taken care of promptly and properly, you know, because there's a lot of accidents happening all over the world. But the thing is, if an accident occurred, you know what you have to do. You know, if a person who is driving, who is drinking and driving, and hit someone, and obviously the kid died, unfortunately, take care of that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let it lead. You know, because when people don't see things happen quickly, then of course, you know, there's going to be animosity. And see, I'm repeating myself again, but that's when the media comes in and starts stuff, and then people get angry. And that's when especially the West Indian community get really upset because of someone from the West Indies, you know? And they're boiling, and the black Americans are boiling, because it's a black person, no matter what, even though we try to distinguish or try to separate ourselves, we're still all one. That's what it boils down to. So it's like everybody got together and say, an eye for an eye. No, you know, the police don't want to take care of this, then, you know, we're going to take care of it ourselves. And the situation almost occurred Labor Day again at the West Indian Parade.
Oh, what happened? I forget.
You know,
I was out
there,
of town.
There was another accident, but similar to a couple.
A couple,
but they were not drinking
and
or
she
anything.
Broke her leg.
Yeah, and the car got out of control. Yeah. I don't know if the couple were nervous because of the crowd or the situation. You know, I mean, paranoia hits sometimes, and things happen. You know, but the fact that it almost occurred again on a second occasion, you know, and the person was let off and blah, blah, blah. See, that could start another riot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but you don't put someone in jail for hitting a person
exactly,
and breaking a leg.
Exactly.
In the best of circumstances, you don't go to jail.
But see, the people understood that, and it was really quiet. The media didn't try to bring, you know, they know they were at fault too, but the media did not try to boost it up. They just said what happened. It was an accident, exactly an accident, you know.
How did it get out, DeLon, that the driver of the car that hit Gavin Cato was drunk?
Because when they, I to be honest with you, I shouldn't even speak on that because I'm only going from what the media said and from, you know, what people say. And I can't really take that to court, but I could just, you know, I'm saying, well, if the media is saying this and people in the community who were at the scene of the accident were saying this, that he was drunk, you know, because when they helped, because they helped him out of the car and everything also, I mean, you know, police came, blah, 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 it was later, but, you know, it's like both parties was taken care of by the people in the community, and, you know. They said he was drunk or he was drinking, and then the media said it. So, you know, everything was justified itself, you know. Whether or not that man was drinking and it was just an accident, I don't know.
Since two summers ago, what's your gut feeling about the media portrayal of the name Crown Heights? When you see it in the papers, on TV. You've lived here so long, and you've said you live in Crown Heights, and people ever
like
even respond to it.
They make Crown Heights to become this like war zone, this negative ghetto type of place. You know, this bad place that we live in. You know, which is wrong. I mean, Crown Heights have some of the most beautiful homes.
Absolutely.
You know, and a lot of good people, you know, more so than bad, you know. I mean, the people in the community, they have several churches. People go to church. People, it's like a community of love. You really, I mean, there's crime everywhere. It's not just Crown Heights. But everything is like now, quote unquote, is being looked at. Anything that happens in Crown Heights is a hype, you know. And it's really uncomfortable. I mean, because when I speak to people and they mention the fact, you know, it's like, oh, you live in Crown Heights, you know, tell us about this or tell us about that. You know, I'm saying, like, you know, well, Crown Heights is really just a regular community, like any other community, but it's just filled with a diversity, like diverse set of people. You know, all these people are all these people from different ethnic backgrounds and stuff. So, you know, it's a warm place until this incident occurred. I know, like Franklin Avenue side streets, blah blah blah. You know, there is problems. There's a lot of drug problems. There is a lot of, you know, hostilities and problems, you know. But that's everywhere you go, there's a good street and there's a bad street, you know. And I feel like I feel it very difficult living in this community these past 2 years, because it's like people don't really want to move in, you know, because it's like the negative, everything is like a negative connotation about it, you know, it's like nothing positive. Just for me trying to find a roommate, it was really difficult, you know. So instead of me mentioning Crown Heights when I'm placed in the ad, I have to, you know, mention close to Brooklyn Museum.
Absolutely.
And, you know?
Grand Army Plaza.
Yes, and close to Brooklyn Museum because I'm like a block away. So that's how I had to list it, because if I had listed Crown Heights, forget it. And when people come here and they see how beautiful and quiet the place is, you know, it's like a total different concept, mm-hmm. you know? But when you tell people stories about a situation, it's you know, or about a community, people just use the negative. Somehow it seems like the negative always override the positive, you know, which is really bad. It's really bad because there's much more good in the community than there is bad. So that's one of the reasons why I'm still here, because I'm comfortable.
Yeah, I think it's really one of the most destructive mm-hmm. echoes
yeah.
from 2 years ago. It's
yeah,
that mm-hmm. examination, as mm-hmm. you say. Everybody's watching.
Right. Waiting for something that I don't know is ever going to happen again.
But there are accidents in cars.
Mm-hmm.
When 12 million people live in one city,
mm-hmm.
there are accidents in cars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm quite sure this was not the first white and black situation, you know? It's like people are people, things happen, but if the media could just stay out of it sometimes instead of hyping it up,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
It's like Los Angeles with the riots, you know? It's like all these different riots happening and you just hype things up. You know, you create madness, you know?
If you were in our museum meeting this mm-hmm. afternoon and you were talking about Crown Heights and things, and I really live here,
mm-hmm.
this is what I want people to know about Crown Heights, what would you tell us?
Well,
you're welcome to come if you'd like to come.
I
it's a hard question to phrase, but
mm-hmm.
but I guess one of the themes that Craig and I